the last time about the concept of revisiting. And it's not just a concept, it's the mechanics of revisiting, which I think is so important to grasp the major themes of this course. I thought I would revisit ancient Greek history and give you a very quick crash course. I want this to be no more than 5 minutes. So, ancient Greek history, as told by me. We're going to start around the 8th century, because that's when the Iliad and the Odyssey, as we know it, start taking shape. And we're going to go from the 8th century, just for the moment, till the middle of the 5th century. We'll call this the Archaic period. Then we'll go from the middle of the 5th century to 399. We'll call that the Classical period. I don't know what to call things after that, because as far as I'm concerned, things still go strong. But what happens in 399? Socrates drinks hemlock, is executed by the Athenian state. Then how far further do you want me to go? Shall we go to 323? The death of Alexander the Great? That will be a good way for my lectures to come to an end. But you see, the history of Greek civilization in general, and Greek song culture in particular, goes on and is alive and well today in so-called modern Greek culture. So this is an amazing span of time, and add to that that I'm starting artificially around the 8th century, because that's when the Iliad and the Odyssey start taking shape. But I could easily go to the middle of the 2nd millennium before our era, because that happened to be my specialty as a researcher when I started out in classics. But because the first pieces of written literature as we know it are the Iliad and the Odyssey, I'm starting to be very handy with the 8th century. Now you're going to ask, when were the Iliad and the Odyssey written down? There's no general agreement among classic specialists. I happen to be one of those specialists, and I think I have the best answer. But I'm not going to impose my specific research agenda on when specifically it was written down, but I thought it might be fun for me to share with you my latest published paper on it. I publish about 2 papers on this topic every year. And so I'll put it on the website just so you see. But as far as our historical background is concerned, all we need to know is that we have no evidence for any kind of scripting of the Iliad and the Odyssey till, best case scenario, middle of the 500s. Best case scenario. Okay? And then how do we have the text that we have? Well, it has to do with editors who lived well past the classical period. The most able one thriving around 150 BCE. So if you want to say, well, where does our text come from? I'd say it comes from the editorial work of scholars done around 150 BCE. Now, another thing we have to know in our crash course on Greek literature, on Greek history, which I'm trying to tie into Greek literature, is that there are many cities involved in Greek civilization. And you have to look at the history of Greek civilization in terms of cities, not in terms of a country or a nation state, because they didn't have anything like that. And it's also important to understand that each city had its own customs, including song culture customs, and including religious customs, which are 2 very interconnected things for us, so that we can't easily generalize about what the ancient Greeks were unless we go city by city. And in my crash course, which is rapidly coming to an end, since my 5 minutes are coming to an end, there are about 6 very important cities that we have to keep constantly in mind. And hands down, the most important of all these cities is Athens. Athens happens to be the locale where the Iliad and the Odyssey, as we know these productions gelled, crystallized, even became a text sooner or later. Athens is also the place that pioneered a form of song-making tradition called tragedy, which is the other big literary form that we have been accustomed to. And when we were reading the Heracles of Euripides, I know you probably got a kind of culture shock in having something that is chronologically later being introduced earlier. So let's just say that's in the classical period, sometime in the second half of the 5th century. But the bottom line for that as well is that it's produced in Athens. So we have, if I may put it this way, a very ethnocentric view of ancient Greek song culture because of the historical fact that everything seems to be funneled through Athens as far as we, the inheritors of Greek civilization and Greek literary traditions, are concerned. Now, why can't I date for you more precisely the Iliad and the Odyssey? It has to do directly with what we saw in the clip the last time we met, which is that real-life performance of a heroic song by an oral poet. And the key is oral poetry. We happen to see an illustration of oral poetry taken from the former Yugoslavia, recorded in this particular case in the mid-1930s. We saw that the singer, Abdo Medjedovic, we in the trade just call him Abdo for short, A-B-D-O, was going at this very rapid clip, 10-syllable verses, one after the other. And what was he doing? He was not performing something that was memorized. He was actually creating the song all over again. And this is the fundamental truth about oral poetry, the study of which was pioneered at Harvard, which is that composition and performance are aspects of the same process. And you saw Abdo doing it right there. And if you want to see what he was singing about, Casey has the not only the clip, but also the words of what he's singing, and a little bit of background historical information about what this kind of singing tradition was like in the former Yugoslavia. What's ironic to us, I think, is that if you asked Abdo what language he speaks, he wouldn't say Serbo-Croatian, which is what I guess we would call it if we just describe it linguistically. He would say, I'm singing Bosnian. And what's also interesting, there are other singers whose songs were collected by Milman Parry and Albert Lord, those two Harvard pioneers of the study of oral tradition. And in the case of some of these other singers, they would be singing not in Bosnian, but Albanian. And sometimes they would be singing about the same great events of their remote past. To take just one remote past, this date means nothing to most of us. 1389, and I'm not requiring it for the course, I'm just saying as a fact, 1389 was when the Battle of Kosovo happened, K-O-S-O-V-O, and this is the place which is the focal point for all the ethnic strife and atrocities in the former Yugoslavia right now. A few years ago it was Bosnia, now it's Kosovo. Depending on whether you belong to a culture of the losers or the winners of the Battle of Kosovo, your epic traditions are different. And what's amazing is that Parry and Lord could even find bilingual singers, people who could sing either in Albanian or in Bosnian, depending on what language you sing. The perspective on the outcome of the Battle of Kosovo is different. And by the way, this doesn't count as part of my 5 minutes. I've finished. You noticed my sketch of ancient Greek history. Now I'm going rapidly into the topic of oral poetry and giving you a very quick summary. This too will only last 5 minutes, and I've already used up about one or two of those. a little bit more about oral poetry. Milman Parry went to the former Yugoslavia in the first place because he wanted to see whether Homeric poetry, the poetry of the Iliad and the Odyssey, works the same way as examples of living oral poetry. And the best case he could find back in the 30s was the former Yugoslavia and the still living oral traditions that were thriving then. But imagine that old man Abdo who's singing a heroic song. Most of the agenda have to do with the conflicts between different cultures. And in the case of Abdo, if I can put it this way, the good guys are the Muslims. The good guys are the upper strata of society who are faithful to the beys who ran the palaces of the Ottoman Empire in southern Europe. And what his songs conjure up are the glory days when the beys and the pashas were in control and their heroic deeds and what their exploits were. And of course the palaces were gone by the time of Abdo. So what's left? Coffee houses. Because this kind of song culture could go from palace to private home to coffee house. Coffee houses were still around. And a typical way for people to spend their time is listening to the singer of tales, just like that. And what do? They sing about the glory days of the past. And what does that mean primarily? What's the number one emotion? Nostalgia. Or should we call it sorrow? And why am I saying nostalgia? Because I can revisit right now in our handout for today that scene of nostalgia that we saw the last time. I can look at the same passage today, which we saw the last lecture, and give you a completely different interpretation, or let's say give you different angles of the interpretation, because now we have gone further and we have had a chance to look at further things. So I'm going to emphasize different things this time as I revisit this passage. So the point of my exercise is you look at focus passage A and you say it's the same one that we had the last time. Yes, it is the same one, but the point is we now have a different key word. So look at footnote one. Because as we see me unpacking my key word for today, you'll see a different slant or a different angle. Today's word is noos. Last time we had the word nostos, which is in footnote two. But in footnote one, here's the operative word for today, noos. And this is, as George Bush would have said, I wonder if W uses the same kind of expression, the mental thing, the mind thing, nous. It designates realm of consciousness, rational functions, intuition, perception, and then something much more complicated and mystical. I'm deliberately using the word mystical today. The principle that reintegrates the thumos and psyche after death. I better unpack that. Thumos, we're still in footnote one, is what you think with and what you feel with. In other words, it's mental and emotional faculties that it refers to. And psyche, how can I put this, is what you live with. If you lose this, you're dead. And we've been revisiting psyche so many times. We've already seen it in so many contexts. Today, I'll simply emphasize that it's your life when you're alive, and it's a disembodied conveyor of your identity after you're dead. But somehow, the nous, this mental word, is the key to whether you can ever get your psyche back. And I don't know whether you can start seeing the subtext of what I'm driving at. And today I can only drive at it, we'll have to keep revisiting this topic, is that there's a relationship between the word nostos, of the last time we met, and noos, the word that we meet today. And I think you could see what the relationship might be when I was translating Nostos. Let's now turn to footnote 2. Remember, I translated it, looked at the second sentence as coming to. It's where you regain your consciousness. And if it means return to consciousness, then the very word nostalgia, which I revisited the last time and I revisit again today, has special meaning, since the Odyssey says it's about the argeia, the pains, the sorrows, the woes of Odysseus, and it's about how this hero, Odysseus, tried to achieve the homecoming. So now as I step back and look at this focus passage A, which has so much packed into it, I'm seeing not only the story of a sailor who came back from the sea, which is, I think, what the emphasis was the last time. I'm not even seeing so much the warrior of Troy who returns to Ithaca. I see somebody who went through so many ordeals that it's as if he died and then came back to life again. I'm just suggesting this now. I haven't established this. I'm just suggesting it, that that is a deeper meaning in this focus passage, this all-important focus passage that begins the Odyssey. I'm also suggesting that if we understand the agenda of Greek history, which I outlined for 5 minutes, and if we understand the agenda, if I can use the word agenda again, of oral poetics, which is recreating something each time you perform it, recomposing, renewing, in the here and now, I suggest that we will start to see that what you have here is a blueprint in Focus Passage A for initiation into Greek literature. I've been telling you all along that Homeric poetry, Iliad plus Odyssey combined, are the background for Greek civilization, that this is what ancient Greeks have in common. I suggest to you that here, in the Odyssey, which is the sequel to the Iliad, the functional sequel to the Iliad, you essentially have an unpacking of how the Iliad and the Odyssey are a background for us. And so I hope now you see that I wasn't kidding you when I said, look, as far as 5th century intellectuals are concerned, if you know your Iliad and the Odyssey, you have the background, you don't have to worry. Now I think you can see, okay, this is not a history course, this is a literature course, but if, as long as you know those two basic historical facts, that things happened in the context of a city, and that the earliest Greek literature was oral poetry, if you know that, then I think you'll start understanding what the agenda are here, and these agenda do have to do with what the city is all about. What the city, not the heroic world, what the city is all about, number one, and number two, what the medium that articulates the city is all about, and that medium is performance. So once more, this focus passage A is like a reinforcement of all of Greek history, if you like, and the original medium for the articulation of their own history, which is oral tradition, and which is eternally self-renewing. And if you're worried, oh, I don't get it, I don't get the meaning, you see how it's not the history that will give you the meaning, it's being able to read their way of communicating themselves. And it may be irritating to us that they speak in the mode of, here it comes, initiation. But that's just the way it is, and that's why it's a struggle for us. It's an initiatory medium. It keeps challenging us. It keeps saying, are you ready to read this? Are you mentally, morally, emotionally qualified? And it's irritating for us because we're so used to being passive readers. It's as if we're ingesting a book. You know, we have a book in front of us. We have to read 371 pages. So we just flip the pages, and it goes in, and it's a passive experience. I hope you see that this is an active experience, because if you're initiated, you have to be actively engaged. So I have, I think, the perfect illustration by way of a clip. This is Mozart. I think Mozart is always the best thing to use for anything that's classical because he understood the classic instinctively. And I'll use the magic flute again, partly because I'm a Hungarian, and Hungarians, with their wacky song culture, actually think that they all understand the magic flute. So you meet any Hungarian and say, oh, I know what the magic flute is about. I'm initiated. It's like the national anthem for us. So I can't help myself. And so you'll see in this scene, again, I use the great master filmmaker, Bergman, Bergman's magic flute, so you'll have to put up with some Swedish instead of German. You'll see this wonderful scene where the hero, who's on a quest, who is being initiated, is finally getting it. And I thought it would be nice for us to get encouragement about what it feels like when you finally start getting it, right? So this is the moment where Tamino gets it. And what I love is that the medium is everything. And the way Bergman imagines this is that the hero, whose name is Tamino, it doesn't matter, is looking at this inscription, and the inscription tells you the secret of the initiation. And so he's reading it and reading it, and meanwhile, Mozart's beautiful music is performing it. But it's as if it were coded in writing, but then the writing has to be unlocked by performance, which is the essence of oral poetry. So let's take a look at this, and I hope it will inspire.
Oh,
Inscription, okay? And then when he turns around and starts singing, he's singing what the secret of the inscription is. In other words, what's coded in the secrets of initiation, the mysteries, when they're finally revealed, are not read by him. He's turned away from the inscription. And he's looking at the camera, right? And he's singing the secrets of the mysteries. And as he's singing on the secrets of the mysteries, you still see, as a sort of second row of subtitles, I hope that you in the front row could see the subtitles, second row of subtitles, line by line, what the inscription of the mysteries was when he had read it. But now he's not reading it. It's, so to speak, engraved in his heart. And that's why he knows that he can just perform it. Now, in real life, as I say, oral tradition does not depend on a pre-existing text. That is mythologized. In other words, you as a performer may think that there's an archetypal text out there, archetypal words, that you're simply repeating. But in the process of repeating, you're recreating. And that is the secret, so to speak, of oral tradition, is that, to repeat, when you perform, you recompose, you recreate. And I think it would be fair to say that as far as the ancient Greek song culture is concerned, going back one more time to passage A, every time the Odyssey is re-performed, it is new. And it renews the city, which is the essence of Greek civilization, as we saw in the 5-minute crash course. If you want to revisit my 5-minute crash course, I know that in the sections, the section leaders can give you copies, or on the website, I had given this 5-minute crash course to you at the very beginning in lecture one. But, you know, it's easy to forget about things that teacher said in lecture one, so I want you to revisit. Now, what was the number one goal in this hero's quest? Remember, he says light and truth, and that he'll go through anything, any ordeal, to get to light and truth. Now, of course, what makes Mozart is what does the light and truth turn out to be in a sort of physical realization? It's the girl that he is yearning for, who then suddenly appears and says, here I am, and then suddenly light and truth and everything come together. A little bit like Il Postino, where you take the theme of Dante, the greatest of Italian poets, has this female love, Beatrice, as the goal for his poetic striving. So it's the goal and the inspiration for all of his creative activity. So I guess how to put this, love is a very important drive towards light and truth. But now I'm emphasizing light and truth, because in the Odyssey, that is the number one symbol for getting it. And I'm going to emphasize today light, specifically the idea of returning to light as the key to the mysteries, as far as the Odyssey is concerned, the key to enlightenment, the key to understanding, to getting it. So that, if I may use the metaphor of what we're doing, the ordeal of our reading, the Odyssey because it's a struggle. The ordeal of our reading results in an illumination. There's some rough points in the zigzagging of our hero who seems to be always off balance in the Odyssey. In passage B, focus passage B, he has just landed on the island of Circe, C-I-R-C-E. And he's going up to an elevation. He's looking around, and he realizes this is not home. This is, again, a false homecoming. He's not home. He's not in Ithaca. He's in some strange island. So he goes back down to the bottom of the hill, and he announces to his friends that he, line two, has no idea where the sun either sets or rises. What is our number one metaphor for this kind of expression? It's such a cliche that we don't even think of it when we say it, but we say, I am disoriented. And when you say disoriented, it means I don't know where the east is, I don't know where the west is. And remember, this is the pilot. This is the helmsman. This is the hero of intellect who always knows his bearings, who can always find his way out of anything. And his men rely on him for that. Remember I was saying that the agenda of the Odyssey is really the city? The Odyssey doesn't say it explicitly, but he's not only the pilot of the ship, he's the pilot of the ship of state, because the Odyssey, as well as the Iliad, always has ships of state as the number one symbol for government. You say, wait a minute, there was no government yet in the Heroic Age. But you see, that's the whole point, is that the Heroic Age is just a way of looking at your here and now, because oral tradition renews and renews and renews. We're dealing from the 8th century through the 5th century. And let me tell you, the agenda is the city. And the agenda is, what is the ship of state? What kind of government do we have? Okay? So this is a terrifying moment when suddenly the leadership just gives up and says, I don't know where I am. I don't know where we're going to go from here. Look at the reaction of Odysseus' men. They start weeping uncontrollably. Their hearts sang, look after 198, as they heard me, for they remembered how they had been treated by the Lacedaemonian Antiphates and by the savage ogre Polyphemus. They wept bitterly, etc., etc. Now, what do Antiphates, the Lacedaemonian, and the Cyclops have in common? Any idea? Do you remember what Antiphates, the Lacedaemonian, does to people? All right, he eats them raw. He's a cannibal, just like the Cyclops. And your fearless teacher decided, wouldn't it be interesting to take the adjectives, the ornamental adjectives, which we in the trade call epithets, that describe these ogres, and see how they play out in the Iliad. You know how they play out? This epithet system that applies here to cannibals applies in the Iliad to Achilles. You say, wait a minute, Achilles is the number one hero of the Iliad. We admire him for achieving the ultimate in humanity. But remember, he has some very questionable moments. And I've already been driving home again and again how that's the basic idea of the hero, is that they go up and down, they're dynamic, they're not static. And I would say Achilles' worst moment in the entire Iliad is when he's standing over the dying Hector and says, I wish that my thumos, my heart, could impel me to cut you up and eat you raw. Not even cooking somebody. Just eat somebody raw. This is the depths of bestiality. This is the opposite of humanism. This is everything that the city-state, whose ideals the Iliad and the Odyssey represent, is against. Okay? And so I like to call this an Iliadic nightmare in the Odyssey, just to keep us aware of the depths to which a hero can sink, as well as the heights to which he or she can ascend. Now, there are many ways to do this next one. See, I have sort of a 1-hour version, 2-hour version. I better do micro compression, which is, think of it intuitively, when Odysseus leaves Troy, what direction does he go in? He goes from east to west. And he goes further and further west in order to get to Ithaca, his home. Now, I know there are lots of zigzags, and we could spend many hours talking about the zigzags, but ultimately he reaches the island of Circe, which we saw in passage B. Okay? By that time, he's at the extreme east, extreme west. You can't go farther west than that. And that's when he goes down into Hades. Now, here's the thing, is the way he goes to Hades from the island of Circe is the way the sun sets. And I have to make this very quick, but every time you see a Homeric sunset, what actually happens is the sun goes into a cosmic river that surrounds our Earth, which is round and flat. Okay? And every time somebody dies, their psyche, goes into the same cosmic river. And because this cosmic river surrounds our universe, it means that when the sun rises, it comes out of the same cosmic river. But here's the thing. When you're talking about journeys of souls, you can talk about a psyche going down into the cosmic river the night before, but you can't talk about the psyche coming out of the cosmic river the morning after. You can only say that about the sun. You can't say that about human experience. There's something taboo about it. And we'll examine that in lectures to come. But what really gets me is that after Odysseus's journey to hell, so to speak, but we promised each other not to call it hell because Hades is transitional. It's not where you end up, it's transitional. After Odysseus goes down to Hades, he's going to have to come up again after he finds out various secrets, which we'll discuss the next time we meet. When he does come up for air again, so to speak, is in C. After we left the stream of Okeanos, that's the freshwater river into which the sun sets and out of which the sun rises, okay? And had got out into the open sea, we went on till we reached the island of Aiaia, that's Circe's island. And look at this, where the dawn has her dwelling and her place to dance, and where the rising of the sun happened. So you see what has happened is we've come full circle. What had been the island of Circe, which was in the far west, is now the island of Circe in the far east, is in the process of going down to Hades and coming back up again. Odysseus has somehow mystically come full circle. And now the island is no longer in the west, it's in the east. This is what psychologists like Jung, J-U-N-G, called the coincidence of opposites. You push the idea of far west far enough, and next thing you know, you're in far east. Or as grandmother used to say, what goes around, comes around. Okay. Now look, this is a mystery. You have to be initiated into it. And I'm only sort of at the beginning of my journey in trying to initiate us into this central mystery of the Odyssey. But there it is. There's the paradox of how the extreme west has turned into the extreme east. And it's no accident that the island of Circe, C-I-R-C-E, is named after somebody who is the embodiment of circularity. Yeah, see, I'm going to do the other K in about, exactly, and see, Glenn, I'm going to do the other K, not the one that's continuing from here. What amazes me in D is that everything I've said to you about footnote 1 and footnote 2, I'm now on focus passage D. Everything I've said in footnotes 1 and 2 about the relationship between nostos, oncoming or coming to, and noos, the idea of consciousness, everything in those two footnotes comes together in this one passage in D. And can I set it up for you? Odysseus is finally on his journey to Ithaca, to home, and he's traveling on a ship, and he's traveling at night. It's nighttime. And not only that, he's sleeping, which is very important. So he's unconscious, it's happening in darkness, the ship is coming closer and closer to Ithaca. And look at the sleep of Odysseus in line 2. A deep, sweet, and almost death-like slumber. The ship bounded forward on her way, and it's compared to a chariot. And then, if you flip to the second page, the other side, you will see what happens at the precise moment that the ship of Odysseus reaches Ithaca. And that is, the morning star appears, and the morning star heralds the coming of the dawn, in other words, sunlight. So what happens at the precise moment that Odysseus makes it home? The sun comes up, and he wakes up, he comes to. So you see how suddenly the winning back of consciousness, the renewal of patterns of the past in that single glorious, luminous moment, is there at the precise moment that you come home. At that point, the sun shines, starts shining again, and you wake up. Or in the wonderful Bach cantata, Sleepers Awake. And here it is, this one moment. So what I was going to try to do in the remaining moments is show you one more scene of initiation, but we don't have time to see the whole of it. So this is an Apache girl who has just had her first and second menstruations, and at that point she gets initiated in a very elaborate song that is attended by the whole community. And at the climax of the song, what's supposed to happen is the dawn's light happening, and at that same time she, the initiate, turns into a goddess. And the goddess significantly is called in the Apache language changing woman. In other words, it's somebody who's always being renewed every time this moment happens to a new person. And because we don't have time, I'm just going to show you the last few moments precisely before she changes into the goddess in terms of the ritual, okay? So Glenn?
The creation to become the changing woman that we get ready to celebrate.
Thank you.
Okay, now stop here for just a minute. This is an amazing moment because when she's doing this and this, she is the ancestress of all the Apaches, and she is a goddess, and she is being impregnated with the Apache nation as the light of the sun hits. And it all has to be synchronized with the forces of nature, with the precise moment of the dawn. And at this moment, you're not you. You are the goddess. And then when the song is over, then you're no longer a girl, you're a woman. Okay, so it's a truly beautiful moment of synchronizing, and it's all a matter of initiation, and it all comes together. And I use that as my inspiration as I revisit from the last lecture, E and F. You remember E was that oral poetic re-performance of the Iliad, where we see the Iliad all over again, except in 10 verses rather than 15,000 plus verses, right? And what is it again? It's composition in performance, which is a recreation, a renewal, a coming together of everything all over again. It's as if you relive the Iliad all over again. And what happens to Odysseus? He starts weeping, or as the postman says, piangere, which is not just weeping, but singing and weeping. And in F, there's this innocent question by the king. The second time Odysseus weeps like this, because there are three performances and I try to jam everything together in this lecture. But again, the same sort of thing is Odysseus hears Iliadic themes and he weeps. And so when you look at the way the king asks these seemingly innocent questions, is it some near and dear person that you're weeping for? Did somebody die in war? Was it somebody very close to you? Was it maybe somebody, look at the last line, somebody like your own brother? Get it? And you think of Achilles' alter ego and how now, as we'll see much more in detail next time, he's reliving everything all over again. Now, the way I want us to end is with a remarkably short clip. This takes 30 seconds. And it's a very moving moment, having to do with the all-black regiment, most of whom died in the Civil War. And they happened to have an officer who was a Harvard graduate called Robert Rube Shaw. And this happened in 1863. It was, I think, beautifully retold in the film Glory, but I'm not going to show that. What I'm going to show you is a piece of sculpture. And this piece of sculpture you can see if you go to the State House. And facing the State House is this sculpture. And it shows the faces of these warriors, all black, who are going to war, plus their officer, who happens to be white and is the Harvard graduate. Okay? And this particular moment, the way the sculptor did it, his name is St. Gaudens, and you can revisit it on the website where I write you a history of the sculpture. It was constructed in such a way that precisely at the moment of the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, at precisely the moment that the sun sets on Beacon Hill, the last ray of the sun hits the faces of the warriors as they're marching off to their death. Okay? And so then, this will just take 30 seconds. I want you to see this moment, which was actually filmed at a solstice in June, where you can see their faces, and then I'll end with just two lines from the poetry that commemorates this moment of coming together. So, Glenn.
It took St. Gaudens 14 years to finish the monument. The precision of the design is evident on the summer solstice. When the sun sets behind Beacon Hill, the last rays of light fall only on the faces of Shaw and his soldiers.
Okay, that's it. And so now let me read you a composition that the American composer Charles Ives put together. And he also did the words for this, and so I'll just do the words. and this will be the way we end today. He's addressing the faces of the warriors as they're going off to their death at precisely the moment of sunset. You images of God, carved in ebony, a shadow of a sad heart, never light abandoned, moving, marching faces of souls. Thank you very much.